Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. Dear listeners, we have seen this happen before, over and over again. People kid themselves that the war would be over in a few weeks. For a brief while, Victor too hopes that the war will end soon. Unable to leave the town because of his business interests, Victor takes himself to the Hotel Sacher to see out the war with his books on history. However, he does not share the common sentiment that with the Kaiser's support, Austria would soon be victorious, and he is not so sure that after this war, with all its horrors, there cannot be any more anti-Semitic agitation. We will be able to claim full equality. To him, this is a suicidal catastrophe. Imagine the difficulty of running an international financial institution when his country was at war with France, Effrussi et Compagnie, with England, Effrussi and Co., King Street, London, and Russia, Effrussi Petrograd. Still trusting that the war would somehow soon be over, he had dust sheets put over the furniture at the Effrussi Palais, sent his servants home on board wages, sent his family to relatives in the mountains in Bad Iskl, and retired to the Hotel Sacher. The author, Josef Roth, is of the same opinion as Victor, and he foresees catastrophe. He writes, "As soon as the Emperor says good night, we'll break up into 100 pieces. The Balkans will be more powerful than we will. All the people will set up their own dirty little statelets, and even the Jews will proclaim a king of Palestine. Vienna stinks of the sweat of democrats. Gentlemen, unless we start shooting, it's all up in our lifetime, I tell you." After 6 weeks, seeing that the war is taking its time, the family reunites in their Palais home, trusting to see it out as best they can. But there is a lot of activity out in the street. Students chant slogans against France and Russia. Emmy is worried about the effect of this on the children. They are special polyglot children who speak French, English, Russian, but now they are told to speak German only outside the house. With great literary mastery, de Waal now gives us an account of life in Vienna during wartime. How do the children experience the drastic change? How do the adults adapt their lives to the inevitable? Thank you. below the Palais windows on the Ringstrasse, which has been created for the show of grandeur, crowds of unruly students chant, "Serbia must die, one gunshot, one Russian." And the French enemy gets its fair share of insults, of course. There is a loud chant of "Heil Vienna, Heil Berlin, in 14 days we'll be in Petersburg." Victor is torn between his attachment to his new fatherland and the prevailing anti-Russian sentiment. He is, after all, Russian-born, and he loves St. Petersburg. He has not been called to the army, as he is 54, but the manservants in the palais have disappeared, apart from the butler Josef, who is too old to be called up. Victor used to invite friends of the servants, who were between positions, to come on Sunday and share the midday meal of boiled and roast meats. This no longer happens. Pips, Emily's brother, serves as imperial liaison officer with the German High Command in Berlin. A small bevy of maids is kept on at the Palais, as well as a cook and Anna, Emmy's personal maid, who seems to anticipate everybody's needs and to calm everyone's tempers. From her there are no secrets. But there are no grooms, no coachmen, no horses. If you want to go to the Prater now, you take a fiacre from the stand at the Schottengasse, or you go by tram. The house is a lot quieter. "Mama entertained at tea only and played bridge," writes Elizabeth in her short memoir written for the family. Emmy's tailor, Herr Schuster, no longer goes to Paris to buy gowns for his baroness. Still, she dresses up every evening, not to let standards slip. Anna manages her wardrobe, reworking and reusing gowns, adapting them to the latest journals. Elizabeth is clever. She is a bookworm, and she would love to go to school. She is now 15 and has lessons with private tutors at home. She is allowed to go to her brother's school, the Schotten Gymnasium, for a lesson in the laboratory with one of the teachers. Since she was 10, her fondest desire is to leave the yellow-carpeted classroom at the Palais and to go across to the university hall, only 200 meters away. But for a girl, it might as well be 200 miles. Of the 9,000 students, only 120 are female. Elizabeth is now grown up and is very busy with her studies. She is an avid reader and is allowed to get her books bound in half Morocco with marbled covers. Her books are separated from her father's. This is a rite of passage, a way of marking that her reading has significance. She loves opera, Wagner especially, and underlines Deutsch when she records visits to the opera when German opera is being presented. Richard Wagner's ideas and interests were varied and included politics, philosophy, and of course literature. Even if he hadn't been a great composer, the libretti he wrote for his operas have been greatly lauded for their literary value. It is difficult to directly connect Wagner's music with politics. In his younger years, he got mixed up with extreme radical socialism, which was strongly tinged with nationalism. His secondary involvement with the May 1849 uprising in Dresden resulted in a 12-year absence from the Germany he loved so much, being exiled, of course, and with a price on his head. Radically left-wing as he may have been, Wagner yet did not disdain the help of aristocratic friends, and later he exploited to the full King Ludwig II of Bavaria's infatuation with him, personally as well as with his music. However, whether Wagner liked it or not, or directly or indirectly fostered it, certain elements used his music and the subject matter of some of his music dramas, as he preferred to call his operas, in order to accommodate their own agenda. The two elements which come to the fore are patriotism and racism, to be taken here to mean anti-Semitism. For some time, he himself, fed upon rumors and uncertainties, since dismissed as just that, rumors, regarding his real parentage. Having been born 6 months after his legal father's death, he was believed to have been the son of a Jewish actor and playwright called Ludwig Geyer, friend of his legal father, and who started living with Wagner's mother. Until Wagner was 14 years old, he was known as Ludwig Geyer, and he believed he was Geyer's son. His later anti-Semitic ranting could have been seen as protesting too much, and a means of diverting attention from this mix-up. As regards politics and nationalism, Wagner's glorification of ancient German myths and legends, as well as Germany's rich medieval heritage, came to appear to some minds as a justification for unbridled power, expansion, and weird racial ideas. The blatant and extremely cruel form of anti-Semitism under the Nazi regime did not just appear from nowhere, but was unfortunately fostered by a centuries-old tradition which had frequently manifested itself in horrible pogroms, especially in times of crisis and during the medieval crusades. However, this was nowhere as systematic and ruthlessly planned and executed as between 1933 and 1945. By then, Germany had been a major participant in both world wars. The phenomenon of nationalism had also affected Wagner. Just consider the Ring legend with its gods and heroes of Valhalla, and the medieval heroes such as Lohengrin and Tannhäuser. The brilliant political and diplomatic strategy, as implemented by the Prussian Chancellor Bismarck, resulted in three wars in which Denmark, Austria and France were all crushingly defeated in the space of just 6 years. Denmark and Austria would never be able to redress the humiliation of defeat, but France remained an implacably hostile and unreconciled enemy, unable to stomach the loss of Alsace-Lorraine. Although not a paragon of real democracy, the new German Empire, or Second Reich, was free and united under Prussian leadership. Wagner died in 1883, and things were to change a few years later. A famous what-if of history tantalizes observers. Kaiser Wilhelm I died in March 1888 to be succeeded by his liberal-minded son Friedrich, who was already dying of throat cancer. The new emperor died just 99 days later and was succeeded by his son Wilhelm II, who, chafing under Bismarck's direction of affairs, dismissed him in 1890. What if Friedrich had lived longer and enacted liberal reforms? What the headstrong young Kaiser embarked upon was to lead to trouble, music or no music. Knowing France's implacable hostility, Bismarck sought to isolate her.
maintained good relations with Great Britain as well as with Russia. Wilhelm II's jealousy of Great Britain was to result in a race for naval supremacy, and with France, a race on the military level which Germany had already won and sought to maintain. A probability of a war on two fronts became very likely when German support of Austrian ambitions in the Balkans brought about an inevitable clash with Russian interests. This was indeed a prelude to the dramatic changes which were to come. The war to end wars of a century ago proved futile because 20 years later, the needless humiliation of a defeated Germany played into Hitler's hands and was to bring about World War II. It was a shame that Wagner's music was hijacked by the Nazis in such a shameless way.
Her younger brother Ignaz, Iggy, attends the Schotten Gymnasium, a very good school run by the Benedictines. Though the teachers are brothers, many of the pupils are Jewish. The school is only 3 minutes away from home. To Iggy, aged 9, the war means playing soldiers with his cousin Pitts. Tucked away behind a false door in the servants' spiral staircase, 136 steps that go up to the roof, where suddenly you are above the caryatids, above the acanthus leaves, and you have a 360-degree view of the whole of Vienna. As de Waal writes, turn slowly clockwise from the university, then the Votivkirche, then St. Stephen's, all the way back through the towers and the domes of the Opera and the Burg Theatre and the Rathaus to the university again. Iggy knows all the uniforms of the Imperial regiments. He loves sketching and colouring them. An aesthete in the making, he also furtively loves to draw dresses. He becomes his mother's advisor on dress. Together, they frown at Elizabeth's lack of dress sense. Netzuke now lie, rather forgotten, in the black vitrine. And though Gisela and Iggy still spend time with their mother in her dressing room, they are older now. You don't play with the Netzuke on the carpet if you're a girl of 10 and a boy of 8. That's rather childish. Below the Palais windows in the Ringstrasse, which has been created for easy living, for strolling upon, for gossiping over coffee at a cafe, students noisily chant slogans, soldiers march by, people queue to purchase different commodities, milk, potatoes, cigarettes. There is hoarding, and people part with precious possessions in exchange for food.
Was a lot of discontent. Food shortages and bread riots were common. Thousands of soldiers never returned home. And those who did were disgruntled, demoralized, and added to the discontent. Socialist radicals fanned public opinion against the state, and they played upon the general misery war brings about. Russia collapsed, and the revolutions of 1917 there led to the new Soviet government to seek terms with Germany. So by March 1918, Russia was out of the war. Germany could transfer thousands of soldiers from the Eastern to the Western Front. There was a massive, desperate final offensive there, which failed by June.
Vienna is invaded by 100,000 Jewish refugees from Galicia, driven out by the terrible expulsions by the Russian army. Some are put up in barracks where there are basic amenities, but quite inadequate for families. Many find their way to Leopoldstadt and live in appalling conditions. The IKG, the Organization for the Israelites, organizes relief efforts. And here again, as I have said, history repeats itself, and never would Austria have expected yet another inflow of refugees such as it has seen in recent months, albeit from different sources. These newly arrived Jews are looked at askance by the more assimilated Jews who arrive half a century earlier, and who fear that in such great numbers they will make assimilation difficult. Again, the Wall quotes Josef Roth. No one will do anything for them. Their cousins and co-religionists, with their feet pushed under desks in the first district, have already gone native. They don't want to be associated with the Eastern Jews, much less be taken for them. Allow me to interject. How cruel a fact of life, and how oft repeated. But the IKG remains dutifully faithful to the empire, and in March 1916 makes another call for funds towards the war effort. The Jews of Vienna contribute another 500,000 crowns to the war loans. A very revealing chapter, this, entitled Heil Vienna, Heil Berlin, in which the Wahl succeeds splendidly in mixing the historic events of the state with the effect that the changed atmosphere has on the daily life of the Afrosi family in Vienna. He writes, "Before the war every summer, there was an operation with ladders and buckets and mops over the courtyard roof. Because there are no manservants, the glass over the courtyard has not been cleaned for 2 years. The light is greyer than ever before." An ominous statement, as we shall later see. And this brings me to the end of this episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories. Be with me next week for a continuation of the story. Once more, I thank Albert Storace for his interesting interventions in this programme.